I've got several questions that I will raise. I'd like to raise a couple of questions that frankly have come over the internet, because again, what we're trying to do is to experiment or see how we can make the hearing process include more individuals. I think this is a particularly interesting question because it really does make us focus on how we take advantage of this information age and as we move into this new century, but at the same time recognizing there are people we have to be concerned about. And this question, here's what how the question is posed. First of all, it says, thank you for this opportunity to ask a question of the witnesses. This truly is a 21st century hearing with ordinary citizens like myself, when ordinary citizens like myself can participate in a real hearing. As a resident of rural areas, I am concerned that the information revolution will bypass me and my fellow citizens. What can we do to make sure that the economy still encourages our rural way of life? I don't know whether anybody wants to respond, has any particular thoughts about that. Mr. Janetsky, do you want to respond to that?
Not really.
All right.
Well, you know, I think I'll respond to it, Mr. Chairman, because I come out of an industrial community, and we're part of, we've not been considered part of the third wave, traditionally speaking. And the fact is, you just got to get with it. Manufacturers, if they hadn't gotten with the information age, and we really are the information age now, would have gotten left behind. And I think the same is true of the rural parts of our country, and that means that the responsibility is back on the person who asked the question in part. And what we can do in Congress and our education and our governmental systems is continue to bring this information forward, but you really don't have a lot of choice. You have to become modestly computer literate. You have to pay attention to this whole new set of items, and you got to encourage people who are young to gather the skills. I have young children. They are all already computer literate. One of them's a 7-year-old, the other's 11-year-old. They compose on the computer. It's no big deal for them. And certainly the expense is not so extraordinary. So I think it's a matter of education, cultural change. Get with it. I think that the rural part of the country is doing that. And so I encourage the questioner to pursue it, and that's what you got to do.
Very good. Anyone else have an interest in responding to that? I might just take your response and build on that, because, you know, back when in the early days of the discussion of the so-called third wave, information communications and so forth, you always heard, at least from the folks who represented the so-called smokestack industries, there was a tremendous amount of nervousness that just like this person raised in the question,
right.
Manufacturing was saying, well, wait a minute, don't forget about us. I mean, this is the heart of America. This is the foundation upon which we've been built, and you guys want to go off into this information age. Is there anything that the manufacturing sector of America should be concerned with this so-called third revolution or the information age?
I think there really is not a lot that is not positive, Mr. Chairman, and I would just say that the third wave information revolution and manufacturing are now so in sync that they are one and the same. 50% of the capital spending in the last couple of years in manufacturing has been in computer and information processing items. The factory floor has been revolutionized. Everything from computer-aided design to computer-aided integrated manufacturing is done. Workers are now trained on it. Even CEOs are forced to learn about it, which is sort of the last refuge. The CEO sitting in his office with a box that he couldn't operate, even he is, like myself, getting into email and all those other things. And so, and it's made us faster. It's allowed us to do it cheaper. I think the downside, you know, is in spending too much money on equipment too fast before you've trained people. People have done that. That's about the only big downside. You got to be careful not to spend stuff on a lot of equipment that you don't yet know how to use properly.
My own reaction, and I'm going to, after this comment, I'm going to turn to my colleague, Senator Bingham, to ask him to engage in this, and then I'll ask some additional questions. But my own reaction of observing how the country has responded to this information age, looking back, you look at the agricultural sector where we had, where that was the foundation of the of our economy for decades, where a large percentage of employment took place in the agricultural sector. That today, what has happened in the as the Industrial Revolution came on, eventually agriculture adapted and adopted the technologies that were developed in the
right.
Industrial Revolution and made
right.
them much more productive, much more profitable. We did a lot more with a lot less. And what I sense is happening in the manufacturing sector is that what they have done is that they've adopted and adapted the information and knowledge of this new wave into new the development of new technologies for production.
Exactly. And that's, of course, the way you compete. And you compete by adapting. And that's what manufacturers have done with respect to technology, although they now have, in many cases, the leader, because we make many of these products in manufacturing that they use in the information age.
Any other responses out there before I turn that over? I think I see a smile there on Mr. Drunetsky's face. Did you want to participate?
I think the main concern of that person is that the rural area is going to be left out of this in technological and informational revolution. And so long as anyone has a telephone, they're going to be part of it. This very experience that we're going through today shows us that regardless of where you're located, if you have a telephone connection, you have a small computer, you have the ability of participating in every way, shape, and form in the next revolution.
Very good. Senator Bingaman.
Thank you very much. Let me ask Mr. Jasnowski a question. I agree with your recitation of the progress that American manufacturers have made to become more competitive. One of the essential things, though, from my perspective, as a larger and larger percentage of our business is in the international economy, an essential part of what it's going to take to compete in the international economy is to have a good partnership between our industry and our government so that we can assure that we have equal access to foreign markets along with other competitors. That's my own view. I notice in your recommendations you say our export promotion policy should be maintained. I've been concerned that one of the proposals that was in the House budget and in the Senate budget was we should eliminate the Department of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And in the House, they got so specific as to say the International Trade Administration should be eliminated. And both budget resolutions call for drastic cuts in federal support for export promotion, Export-Import Bank, but a variety of things. I've had a conversation recently with Jeff Garton, who, of course, was head of the International Trade Administration, is head of it. And he makes a fairly compelling case that rather than cutting back in these areas, we should try to make as much of an effort as our French or German or Japanese counterparts are making. And he points to the fact that, for example, in China, which is an enormous potential market for U.S. manufacturers, we have 7 people in government trying to assist, which he says is just a scratch in the on
right.
the surface of what should be done. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether export promotion should be maintained at current levels, whether the function of government in helping business to export is a valid function in this new world, and whether we should be shutting down the International Trade Administration and the Department of Commerce.
Well, I think you ask a great question, Senator, and I appreciate you putting it forward. If I had my own way, I would certainly expand the resources going into XM Bank and exports generally because we're behind our international competitors. The problem with simply going forward with that is that we have an alternative objective, which is to reduce the budget deficit. And I think that my sense is that everybody under these conditions has to take a cut. And so as corporations have come back to me and say, I want you to go and protect this program and I want you to protect that program, I've said to them uniformly, based on consultation with my leadership, everybody takes a cut in this. And so that includes the Ex-Im Bank. Nobody can afford not to have some cut. And we feel somewhat more sanguine than perhaps yourself and others because of the fact that we reduced our cost in manufacturing by 20% in the last decade and improved our quality. We think we can do that in even the export programs. Having said that, we've been pretty tenacious about opposing extreme cuts in Ex-Im Bank funding. My information was that in some of the House appropriations process that the Ex-Im Bank funding cut was not as drastic as the language you were just using. And we would certainly continue to argue that while they should take their share, we need to be very careful about overdoing the cuts in an area where we're already behind the international competition. With respect to the Commerce Department, having served there, and I think that they have done a good job in this administration, in many cases a great job with respect to expanding exports, and Jeff Garton certainly has, and the Secretary has in occasions too. The problem is you can't defend the Department of Commerce as it stands. And so if you say, I'm going to defend it the way it is, you've got a losing hand. And so our view is that we're prepared to discuss reform in our overall international trade functions. We just want to have a high level of emphasis on exports and negotiations, and we want it to be with a cabinet officer. Now, whether or not you have an enhanced STR or you create some other kind of Department of Trade and Technology, I think that's part of the debate right now. And my first preference wouldn't be to put a priority on eliminating the Department of Commerce, but I don't think you can defend it as it stands. We've chosen not to. We'd rather defend the need for high-level effort because, again, when you're talking about restructuring government, I think everything has to be on the table. And I think the people who have suggested restructuring the Department of Commerce have a valid set of concerns. It doesn't make sense the way it stands, and so why not talk about changing it?
Well, in the budget resolutions that I've seen, they don't propose to restructure it. They propose to eliminate it.
Senator, but may I respond to that, please, from,
certainly.
From an East European
go right
perspective?
Ahead.
I can't think of one real live example in 6 years that I've lived in Central and Eastern Europe of the Commerce Department doing anything to help American businesses boost exports. I think the one thing that President Clinton and Secretary Brown have very effectively done, which, as you indicated, comes close to what some of the European heads of state and senior cabinet level officials do, is I think they've been very helpful on a selective basis at promoting specific large American transactions, which I think they should continue to do. Beyond that, and except at a very senior level, cabinet officer to cabinet officer, I don't really see much assistance that the staff people and the others that are part of this effort do to help. The one thing, Senator, that could be done that would immediately boost American exports would be to reduce trade and tariff barriers, to have a free trade zone, for example, on a reciprocal basis with the countries of Central and Eastern Europe that would participate. That one thing alone would do infinitely more good than any effort that the U.S. Commerce Department or any government agency could do.
Do the firms that you work with take advantage of OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and do you think that that's a factor in their decisions to make the investments that you're helping them make?
I would say this, Senator. OPIC has definitely made a very positive contribution, and I would say that under Ruth Harkin's leadership that they have done more in the last several years than OPIC has cumulatively done in its history. I would say this, that I do believe that most of what OPIC does by providing political risk insurance, by providing guarantees, while it's done so at a cost, could probably be done also on a commercial basis. I do think that the service they provide is very valuable. What they do by being first in the market and often going where the private sector is not yet ready to go is very useful. But I think we should view OPIC's role as a transitional role and one that should only continue until the private sector is ready and willing to perform the functions that they do.
Senator, if I could come back,
yes.
I want to stress again that with respect to the Ex-Im Bank, and the funding that's associated with loan guarantees and various credit measures, that certainly the vast number of major manufacturing projects are positively affected by that. And other competitors use that. Now, if we could get other competitors not to use it, then we could move to something where we didn't have to have it, and there are various proposals around for that. But as long as the other competitors are using those with respect to power stations, aircraft, and the rest of it, we need that. I think in the resolution on the budget, there are not drastic cuts in that. So I think the issue is more the Department of Commerce, and we'll have to debate that, I think, in the next several weeks and months. But we certainly are strongly supportive of the Ex-Im Bank funding and would not want to see drastic cuts in that.
Let me just ask about one other thing. I guess I think that you impliedly answered it. There have been, we've had these technology partnership programs in the Department of Commerce, the advanced technology program specifically that's run out of the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We have a similar in the Department of Defense, the Technology Reinvestment Project, which is a partnership program. Is it your judgment that those are not worth defending either? Is that what I take?
Well, I don't think it's quite that black and white. I really don't think they're defending as they're defensible as they stand. I think that for any of these corporate subsidies, they have to go through the same kind of cost-benefit analysis that we're asking be done in regulations. And I have not, as a part of our institution, defended any program without meeting that test in this budget deficit requirement area. And I think, frankly, a lot of those programs got ramped up too fast, and they couldn't all meet that cost-benefit test. And certainly Congressman Walker is right in putting emphasis on basic research. Having said that, there's a very substantial number of our members who believe that the partnerships themselves are very, very valuable, and that modest amounts of money used in cooperative technology efforts that are in the pre-competitive phase is a set of experiments that the Americans should continue to work at, because it does have payoffs. But again, the emphasis is always put on the partnerships before the money. Everybody believes the money ought to be cut. It's a question of whether or not you eliminate it or reduce it, and that we really ought to be very cautious about large expenditures into areas where there are, you're approaching the border of commercial activities. So I think, frankly, this debate is a pretty positive one. I think we were moving too fast, but our position would be not to eliminate those programs altogether, but to see if we can't manage them more frugally and find better ways to see what their costs and benefits are.
That's all I had, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to address, I guess, both a comment and a question to Ms. French. You probably couldn't see Alvin Toffler when you were making your presentation, because frankly he had moved away from the table and was seated in the audience. But when you were referring to how technology advances in knitting machines and communications allowed for mass customization, and although not intentionally, we became manufacturers producing one-ofs. As an example, last year we produced 20,000 garments, made 885 different styles, giving us an average run of 22 pieces per style, all customized, resulting in $5 million in sales. I mean, you were making the point of what he had raised earlier about this idea that we've got to move away from the concept that everything is better if it's massively done. And so I thought that your testimony in that line was terrific. The question I would ask you, and I'm kind of paraphrase you now, with respect to the problems of communication and government's role and the inability to get answers out of government, I would guess. I made a little note here that one of the main things we ought to focus on is what can we do to pull down the barriers that both inhibit the communication and, frankly, slow down, if not deny, opportunities to establish new businesses. And I would be interested in some of your thoughts as to what you might think those barriers are that that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Well, first of all, may I say I'm not only am I very naive politically, my business skills have been learned as I've gone along. I'm basically a creative person. I make my living as a creative person, coming up with new things that haven't been done before. And I think that my business changed because because all the advisors that I had 5 years ago were telling me that I could not survive and that I had to let go of my business. And I didn't let go of it. I took a creative approach and changed it. So my way of going, of looking at everything is creatively, a true business way of doing it. As far as how you can help us, I wish I knew the answer to that. I would love to tell you. But I do think that by opening up channels, which is exactly what you're doing here, but opening up more channels so that we can have a face to government, feel that government is a friend. If I felt that government was my friend, I think it would be much easier for me on a day-to-day basis. But I'm a little afraid of government. I'm a little afraid of putting a foot wrong, because there are so many things about doing business that I don't know. I may use as an example the fact that I have been able, because of my communication channels, to suddenly become a national company. And so I am able to do business in every state. I am also faced with trying to find out the laws and rules and regulations of all those states, which as a very small company is extremely difficult to do. So I'm involved here in discovering Nexus and use tax, and I think that if Congress could do one thing for people like me who are reaching out nationally to a new audience, you might reconsider the bunker bill, which would make it a flat rate for interstate business. Right now, doing business in 50 states is extremely difficult. Within each state, we have many, many different use taxes, many, many different definitions of what creates nexus. So if I focus on one thing, maybe that right now would be something that would certainly help my life a great deal.
Thank you very much, and again, I appreciate your comments. Just a few additional comments, because we're going to have to wrap this up. To kind of give a sense of how different this hearing is in the way that people have the ability to participate, one of our members of the committee, Senator Larry Craig, was unable to be here today, but sent in a question via internet. He is in Chicago at a conference, and I might just. Isn't this a coincidence? So the person I was going to ask the question to is also in Chicago. Basically, what Senator Craig has said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. What happened to dampen the growth path of the U.S. economy starting around 1973, and what should Congress learn from the experience as we look forward to the 21st century? I wonder if you might have a comment or two on that, Mr. Janetsky.
Sure. I believe that what happened was the increase in tax burdens from calling upon government to do more and more, which it was not able to do efficiently. One thing that we have to focus on is that whenever we ask government to do something else, as great as it may seem, like helping a manufacturer export items to Eastern Europe or something like that, it involves an additional expenditure, involves an additional cost. We can't just focus on what the benefit of this particular program is, because the program may well have some benefit. We have to focus on what the lost opportunity is, because taxpayers are not going to have that money or that resource to go ahead and try and behave as productively and efficiently as they can be. I would also suggest that we look as closely as possible at all this research that I talked about, because the research is really fascinating. If, in fact, it continues to show that whenever government gets involved in anything, that there is a waste of roughly half of the money, we are talking about huge inefficiencies in the economy. When we look back in history, we find that, sure enough, it was the late 60s and the 1970s when we had the most serious and most dramatic growth in the government sector. So it's not surprising to me, I don't think it's surprising to any classical economist, that when government took over more and more responsibilities, that was the time when living standards began to suffer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, let's be brief now, because I've got to wrap
up. I just wanted to reinforce Mr. Gretzky's point about the amount of waste that there is in the system and add the regulatory system to the amount of waste that affected the economy in part with your question. Dale Jorgensen at the Harvard Business School has suggested that the environmental regulations waste half of the waste half of the resources associated with fulfilling them. Again, the 50% figure that he was using, those regulations began to ramp up in the 80s and 90s. And so I think an enormous drag on the American economy in a wasteful sense has been the regulatory system.
Okay. Again, I have just one last question that I'm going to pose, and it's because, frankly, we've gotten a whole series of questions that have come in over the internet that we're just not going to be able to get to this morning, I should say this afternoon. And we will make an effort to try to answer these questions and respond on email. But I think maybe I'll just raise one last question that was kind of directed to me by someone from the state of Florida, Dr. Thomas G. Baumgartner at Chan's Hospital at the University of Florida. It's a whole series of questions, one of which is what should the role of government and its relationship to the development of computer, digital, and telecommunications analog technologies. And I guess my reaction is that I remember the debate that we had back in the 80s about high-definition television, and there was a real effort to try to get the government involved in pushing America into the forefront of high-definition television. As it turned out, that was the wrong thing to do. And my point here is I think what government has to do is provide the environment to enhance growth opportunities and investment opportunities and allow for a free flow of capital into those investments. But we should get out of the business of trying to make a determination about what that investment or what particular product we're making the investment in. On the other hand, he asks another question further down. What role will government play in the exploration of the genome, and how will this affect future generations? And maybe this is a bias as opposed to a good philosophical response, but my inclination at this stage is to say that we ought to, at the federal level, stay actively involved in the National Institutes of Health. At some point when we have a viable alternative, then I think we ought to take a look at that. But so anyway, that's my response to the questions that came in from Florida. And I would just, again, close the hearing this morning, this afternoon, and thank all of you for your participation. And just mention a few organizations that have made this possible: Affinity VideoNet, AT&T, C-SPAN, the Internet Multicasting Service, the Senate Recording Studio, and of course the panelists, and I might add the viewers who participated both through C-SPAN and the Internet. I mean, this is a real example, I believe, of the kinds of approaches that we can take to trying to make government more responsive to its people. So again, thank you for participating, and the meeting is adjourned.